Hello, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based support, educational therapy, academic therapy, and IEP coaching by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. The Special Ed Strategist podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs and the IEP process.
Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you don't follow us, find us on all socials at Learning Essentials and give us a like and a follow. I'm excited to introduce our guest this morning. We are speaking with Sarah Chayette, graduated cum laude in cognitive neuroscience from Princeton University and received her medical degree from the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine. Following specialty training in pediatrics at Cesar Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles and in pediatric neurology at Seattle Children's Hospital, she settled with her family in the San Francisco Bay Area. Sarah practices at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, where she focuses on treating ADHD in both children and adults, and is the author of three books on ADHD, ADHD and the Focused Mind, Winning with ADHD, and ADHD and Me, as well as a book on headaches, Mommy, My Head Hurts. Welcome, and so thankful to have you joining us today. Thank you so much.
Wendy, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
I'm excited for this conversation. I feel like it can go in a lot of directions, and I really want to just pick your brain about ADHD and the work that you're doing and the support that you give families, and how we can translate some of that language and strategy for our educators and our parents to help support them in the classroom and at home.
Yeah, we're going to have a great discussion. I mean, there's so much to talk about, right?
So, That's right.
So we're just going to have to squeeze it in to this little tiny sliver of time we have, right?
Let's try it. We're going to pack it in. We're going to do our best. So you talk about turning ADHD traits into strengths and benefits. What are some examples of this?
Well, you know, I'm just going to say I love people with ADHD as a general rule. You know, I think there are, I mean, I'm trying to suck down my caffeine to get a little bit of their energy this morning. I mean, you know, energy, when did energy get to be a bad thing? Energy only gets to be a bad thing when it's too much unfocused energy. So if we can turn some of that energy into positivity, you know, these people have definite benefits. And, you know, the creativity and the looking at new things or new ways of doing things, you know, you don't have to teach someone with ADHD how to put different things together because of the way their brain works. So I just find that wonderful.
And I love that. And so how can we take that creative, positive slant for learners to be able to capitalize on those strengths in a classroom?
So, you know, the ADHD kids have to learn to believe that they have something to offer the class, because the classroom is not their natural habitat, in many respects. Now, ADHD kids are as smart as any kids on the planet, but sitting in a classroom or listening to stuff they're not that interested in is not a strong point. But they will hear so many negatives. So a typical kid, the best ratio you can offer them is three positives for one negative. So, you know, I really like how you clean the table. You really remembered to put the napkins on the left side and the forks on the left side, and the plates are all where they should be. But next time, don't forget to put the glasses on. So that's three positives for every one negative. an ADHD kid winds up hearing 30 negatives for every one positive. And if you grow up like that, you don't believe you have stuff to offer the world. So, you know, kind of building self-esteem in a realistic way is really helpful.
I like how you phrased that in terms of three positives. And I think that's a good mindset for any classroom or any family parenting situation. I mean, it's not always easy, right, in the moment, but I think it's a really good goal and focus to have.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to do it all at once, but just sort of the overall ratio is supposed to be 3 to 1. And, you know, 1 to 30 is the ratio that ADHD kids hear. So if you wind up hearing like, don't stop, why did you do it that way all the time? Then, you know, that doesn't build self-esteem. I mean, why do we even worry about ADHD? You know, when I talk to people, I ask them, what's the point of focusing anyways? Who cares if you're focused? And the point of focusing, you know, I get different answers, like to get my homework done. And then if I say, well, you didn't really want to do your homework anyways, you know, the point of focusing is not necessarily to get the work done, because the work will be done or not and life goes on. The point of focusing is to get the positive reinforcement from that. So when you finish something, you feel great. People are like, you are awesome. And you're walking around thinking, I am awesome. I am awesome. And awesome people want to go do awesome things. So it is a positive cycle. So the awesome feeling leads to awesome production, leads to more positive feedback, leads to more awesome production. And that's really the point of focus. When you're not focused, you don't do so well. And people say, what's wrong with you? And you say, well, there must be something wrong with me. And then the next time you go up to do something, you don't feel so good about it. And then you don't do such a good job, and then you feel less awesome, et cetera, et cetera. You can really go down a negative feedback cycle fast. Now, everyone with ADHD can focus. Wendy, have you ever met anyone who's unfocused all the time?
No.
maybe people come close, right?
Right, close, but not all the time.
Not all the time. Everyone, you know.
There's no absolutes, right?
Right. And I'm going to say that an ADHD person's brain is just like everybody else's brain, in that it focuses sometimes and it doesn't focus sometimes. But the problem with ADHD thinking, or too much unfocused thinking, is that it can lead you down the kind of rabbit hole of negative thinking, leading to negative production, leading to negative self-esteem, leading to negative thinking, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, everyone focuses sometimes, everyone is not focused sometimes. People with ADHD are not focused too much of the time, so they are more likely to go down the negative feedback cycle than the positive feedback cycle. Anything we talk about from here forward is about how to move from unfocused thinking to more focused thinking. And so how do you get from the negative cycle of failure to the positive cycle of success?
I love that phrasing of that. And so when we talk about kiddos and we talk about the world of special education, we talk about future education, employment, and independence, and how this relates to life skills, how can we support our kiddos with ADHD where this negative cycle might be interfering with those critical life skills? How can we, as parents, as caregivers, as educators, in addition to what you had just mentioned about the 3-to-1 ratio in terms of positive, what else can we do to help with critical life skills that may be impacted by students identified with ADHD?
So, you know, we want to try to train them to think using an athletic mindset. I think that's the best way to phrase it to them, because a lot of these kids are wonderful, wonderful athletes. And you don't have to be an athlete to have an athletic mindset, I will point out. But, you know, if you said to an athlete, you know, do the high jump of 10 feet, they'd be like, no way, Jose, I can't do that, right? So to get somebody to jump the 10 feet or to do something that's hard, in other words, you want to help your child set a small and achievable goal, one that they own, a goal that they really want to do. You know, if your mom is making you play soccer, you're going to play in a certain way. But if you want to play soccer, and especially if you decide you want to win that game, you're going to bring a different level of commitment and focus to the table. So we're all about, how do we improve the focus naturally? And you want to set a small goal that they can buy into and that they can achieve. And then here's the important thing, have some sort of celebration. It does not have to be a catered party for 500. It can be a pat on the back or look what you did type of phrase. And, you know, when we achieve a goal, we celebrate. And it's a celebration. It's that great feeling you get. It's the high fives down the sideline that keep you going. And so you celebrate. You feel good. You feel more hopeful about achieving another goal. Okay, maybe you do another small one. Repeat the cycle a few times. And then maybe your child will feel like, okay, I got this. I'm going to try to set a bigger and bigger goal. But patience, small steps, and just remember that cycle of positive feedback. We have that in my book, ADHD and the Focused Mind. There's a little diagram of a little guy pushing something kind of up a hill. It's like you start small. It's like starting a bicycle uphill. You start slowly, then you get faster and faster and faster. So that's the idea that will keep your child on a positive feedback cycle of success. And that's really what you're trying to build. You're trying to build a child who does that automatically so that you don't always have to be there to coach.
Again, and I think this is excellent advice that can really hit home for all kids, right? And it's interesting what you had just said. I also co-host a book club called On the Same Page. And just yesterday we were talking about the power of choice and, you know, and having that conversation with kids and the power of choice. And it really ties into what you're just saying in terms of making a goal that is their own so that there's buy-in and that they want to, the student, the child wants to work towards something that they feel invested in.
Right. Because it's not about, you know, fourth grade learning, right? Who remembers everything they learned in fourth grade? Not me, you know? It's all about building a model that you take from grade to grade. You build a method. And, you know, a lot of adults get on the negative cycle of failure, right? How many adults will say negative things? You know, sometimes that's certainly well-deserved, but the idea is that you build a way to get from negative to positive that you can use for the rest of your life. And that will make a happy person and a happy life, I really believe.
Absolutely. So then how can we help our friends with ADHD when they're impacted with stress? And how can we help them with stress management? And really, it really doesn't have to always be ADHD, right? I mean, I guess world as we're trying to navigate however many years we're into COVID now in terms of stress management for both kids and adults.
Yeah. And so here's the thing is that let's talk about what stress does to your brain, right? When you are stressed, well, you can think of it as your brain having two parts. You've got the stress part of your brain and the thinking part of your brain. When the stress part of your brain turns on, it physically turns the thinking part off. So, you know, that's probably from the days of see the saber-toothed tiger. You panic. You don't want to sit there and think about it. Like, is that really a saber-toothed tiger? I wonder how fast they can run. I wonder if it can.
You don't
want to
analyze
me.
It, right?
Yeah, you're not analyzing things, and so it does turn the thinking part of your brain off, which means, ladies and gentlemen, that when you are stressed out, you are not thinking right. So you need to know this about yourself, because in the moment, in the stress moment, you're like, but what this and that, and you're trying to think things through, but the thinking part of your brain is physically turned off. So the idea is to find ways to turn off the stress part of your brain and ways to strengthen the thinking part of your brain in the moment. So just having a picture of your two sides of your brain at war, and they are not two sides physically, but that's the idea, that is helpful. And, you know, you can just kind of know that when the stress goes on, you should not pay attention to what you're thinking until you can think straight. So some people do deep breathing exercises or visualization exercises to turn the stress part of their brain off. In some ways, that's also turning the thinking part on, right? Because you have to think about how you're breathing. You want to think about something super, super simple, because you can't think about complicated things until you turn that stress part. My name is, I live at, countdown backwards from 10, something just super, super, super simple. And
three things I see, or two things I smell, or
right, exactly. And what that is doing is helping the thinking part of your brain turn back on and helping the stress part of it turn off. You know, with chronic stress, the thinking part of your brain undergoes physical changes. So the hippocampus, which is a really important part of your brain for learning and memory, shrinks, and the gene expression in the hippocampus changes. And so when stress goes away, you still have this changed new hippocampus. And so, you know, with lots of hits of stress, your hippocampus is going to change and not be able to deal with it as it did before the stress.
Wow. That's fascinating. And so I was over here kind of thinking about what you were saying, and I love the visual of the two parts of the brain. And I think that's really helpful for kids to think of it that way, right? Like you have the stress part of your brain and you have your memory and thinking part of your brain. And I think even just maybe what language would a coach use, right? If we're kind of thinking of that coach mindset,
right,
of supporting, like, and then you could have a key phrase even as an educator in a classroom to kind of say, all right, what would the coach say? Or if you're just with your own child, you know, what, and then come up with a coaching type of phrase to go along with this model to kind of trigger. And then that way you're not, if you're out in public, your child or your student could even do something that's kind of quiet in their head and start to really A, recognize when they feel stress, and B, start to have skills to address it internally with external prompts.
Absolutely. You know, there are kids who, if you say the word therapist or something, they are like, oh, I hate therapy. Like, right. Oh, really? You've met all the therapists in the world and had all the therapy there is? You really hate all of it? But again, you know, a lot of these kids are very used to listening to their coach. So, mm-hmm. You know, if somebody in their life says, pay attention, you know, a lot of these kids are very oppositional. And the minute you tell them to do something, it's like, no. But if the coach says, put your eyes on the ball, they're like, yeah, that's a really good idea.
That's right. And that's a positive way to frame it. And, you know, and even we call it academic coaching, right? For executive function skills and supporting, because then it's the same description of coaching, you know, a basketball team and giving directions and support that way, instead of just more of a team effort versus
absolutely
an adult telling you this is what needs to happen. And you're right. As soon as some kids hear that, they're like, nope, that's not happening.
Yeah, because they view the therapist not necessarily on their side and something that they didn't choose to do. And it means there's something wrong with them. You know, a coach is a little bit more of a obvious shared goal. Like we're in this whole group of people who all have a common goal. And that's something the kid can buy into.
Absolutely. And they can identify with, right? So it's not something that's unknown or unheard of, and they don't feel like they're standing out, but that's something identifiable.
Absolutely.
Their peer group is that term coaching. Can you help me understand then, we talk about ADHD and we're talking about stress. Where does anxiety fit into this?
That's a million dollar question, isn't it? Yeah. Well, again, you know, anxiety or any negative emotion is where the stress part of your brain is turning on. So unfocused thinking leads to anxiety, leads to more unfocused thinking. So it's really a common component of that negative feedback cycle. And, you know, one way to think about ADHD is sort of the difference between having one thing on your desk that you can put all your energy to. So that's like focus thinking, right? You've got one thing in front of you and everything else kind of put away. So your brain goes to that one thing, does it, finishes it, gets the positive feedback. Great. Let's bring out another thing. When you are thinking in a distracted way, and this is true of all of us, it's like different things keep coming to the top of your desk and your brain sees everything. It's kind of having a hard time making one thing be more important because there's just so many things. You're more likely to get distracted by them, of course, but you're also more likely to go like, wow, there's sure a lot of things here. And that makes people more likely to be distracted, more likely to procrastinate, and also more likely to be anxious. It's sort of like, well, having all the messages in your inbox the day you come back from vacation, right? There's 1,000 of them and they're all marked as important. And you kind of look at them and you go like, ah, and then you're like, where's the door? I want to go back to vacation.
That's right. So how does you just brought up procrastination. So how does that come into play with ADHD?
Well, procrastination happens in ADHD, I think more than average, in part because the distractions are drawing people away. And in part because, you know, like I said, everything looks bigger when you don't know one part of it to start. So, you know, one of the questions I ask the kids or adults who come to see me is, you know, they're like, oh, I'm the queen of procrastination. I'm like, girlfriend, I have met the royalty. You know, I mean, everybody says that, right? So I'm sure there's some listeners listening right now who are like, but I thought I was the queen of procrastination. So there are many, many people, and they all kind of say it with this kind of, you know, a lot of people have this kind of smile on their face when they say it. I'm like, well, you know, what keeps you procrastinating?
Good question.
I'm like, you secretly love it, don't you? They'll be like, Well, there are some things that people love about procrastination that make them keep doing it. One is that they feel secretly proud that they can do the whole book report in like 15 minutes and not even read the book. And everybody else took like 3 weeks to do this. So that makes them feel pretty powerful, right? That's one big one. And another big one is that they feel like they can't work until the deadline. And if you think you can't work until the deadline, then you won't work until the deadline. You know, people kind of, this is my method. I wait till it's looming and then I get started. And, you know, laughing now when these 13, 14, 15 year olds look me in the eye and say, this is the way I do things. Like, you're a kid. You can adapt your method just a little bit. You know, when you're ambivalent about something, so you kind of want to change, but you kind of don't want to change. Like you kind of know that you'd do a better job if you started the project earlier, but you kind of like doing it at the last second. You kind of don't wind up changing anything because you're pulled in different directions and, you know, or you do the thing that pulls you more, which is usually the procrastination part. So, you know, I've written a blog on procrastination and I've thought a lot about it because it really is a big problem, but it's really hard to get people to change their behavior a lot of time.
Well, I guess the question then, do they see it as a problem, and is it impacting their life, right? So if it's not impacting their life or if it's not a problem, then change will not happen.
Right. So asking them to think it through, like, you know, what do you get out of, you know, making things obvious. Here's what's keeping you doing it this way. Here's what you tell me. Your lips are saying that you want to start things earlier, but the rest of you has some pull not to do that because over and over and over again, you procrastinate. So making things really clear and often writing things down, having the person write it down if they're game, like reasons to procrastinate and, you know, look at it from that person's point of view. If I procrastinate, I will get to do my games, you know, 2 hours longer. If I procrastinate, I will feel good because I'm not working. If I procrastinate, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, trying to think through, but if I do it early, you know, I might actually get a better grade. I will feel less stressed about it. I will be able to have all the things I need. I will feel terrific about the project when I turn it in, knowing that I've done my best. And, you know, you don't always play to win, right? Sometimes you just play to get it done or just not to lose, right?
Right.
Sometimes you just play for fun and it's okay. And, you know, sometimes you choose not to play. Being really clear about the level of commitment that you're going to bring to whatever it is, you know, it doesn't always have to be play to win, but, you know, that person should try to be clear and not say that they're wanting A's when they don't want to put an A level of effort into it.
And that there in itself can drive some parents crazy.
Yes, it can.
So what advice do you give to parents?
How many times did I say to my son when he was a kid, if they give you 10 lines to write your answer in, they do not want you to write a 3-word answer. So,
yes, ma'am. Right?
Look at it from the kid's point of view. Like a little kid, they don't care about doing their best. Their goal is to finish it quickly. At least a lot of little kids. I can't speak in general. Male little kids who live at my house. But no, you know, a lot of smaller children, particularly, their goal is not to do the best job they can because, you know, it really doesn't matter to their lives. Their job is to finish fast. And so you know, that might be okay in certain circumstances. As people get older, they're a little bit better able to see that their actions have consequences and that, you know, they may want to put some more effort into what they do. But sometimes, you know, if your kid is not the best kid in second grade, that's okay. You know, but there's lots of time.
That's right. There you go. That's a good perspective there. So thinking about that and kind of just our conversation so far, I hear a lot in terms of reading strategies and kids that are distracted while reading longer passages. Can you recommend some reading strategies to help our friends that have ADHD who tend to lose focus while they're reading?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I can teach people how to read, but I can remind everybody that reading is a skill that you lose if you don't use it. And I love reading. I'm a big reader. Love, love, love. But even I can't read if my phone is next to me. I mean, I just wind up checking my phone or doing this. electronics are so easy for your brain. You know, they make them that way. It's like eating sugar all the time. And then when you bite into an apple, you're like, ew, this is sour. But like, guys, the apple is real life and the phone is sugar, right? So, you know, try to make reading an important thing in your family. Try to, you cannot tell your children to read if you're on your phone all the time too. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, reading should be something you talk about. Reading should be something that your family sees you do too. So like any skill, it takes practice, it takes time. And if it's, I believe it's really important to be able to get information out of books. I think it's really important. Well, I think it's really fun to have adventures in books. You know, I've been sailing in the Antarctic in the books. I've been, you know, to countries I've never visited, had adventures I never would want to have. And I love reading. And it's sad when I see people reading less and less.
You know, it's something we've done as a family. We have three boys. They're each 3 years apart. And we have done books, like read a book as a family.
Nice.
And, you know, even to the little ones, like we'll read out loud so they can hear it. And then we followed up with watching the movie. And that was a really good experience just as a family activity, but then also bringing in the importance of reading. So I just kind of, as you were talking, it just popped in my head.
Plug that one, because that is terrific.
And it's just super great because, you know, just because it's varying ages, not everybody can read independently, but it's nice just to sit and read out loud. And then we just kind of had fun with it and did the movie. And we've done that a couple times. And that was a great way to just bring the family into that love of reading. So let me ask you, how about ADHD? We talk about, you know, anxiety and procrastination. What about sensory overload?
Sensory overload is, you know, we all experience the world through our senses, right? I mean, we've got our five senses and, you know, we all, that is how every single person experiences the world. So you can interpret so many things in a sensory way. But another way of saying sensory overload is saying that that person is paying more attention to certain parts of their senses than you are. So, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm smelling my coffee, I'm smelling, well, hopefully nothing else, but I am looking at things, I'm hearing things, I'm seeing things, but I'm paying attention to you, Wendy, because my brain is prioritizing our conversation over all the other things. If you have a brain that's naturally paying attention to lots of different things or going from thing to thing, that brain may be paying attention to senses more than another brain. And the result would be feeling anxious because there's so much coming at you at once.
Then how can we help our family and students and clients, recognize this, or how do we help kind of calm those senses down?
Yeah, so I don't think you can talk about sensory overload or sensory sensitivity or all these other things without using the word anxiety. I think it all involves anxiety. And then it gets back to that model of the brain where you have the anxious part of the brain or the emotional part of the brain and the thinking part of your brain. So sensory overload is handled like other stresses too, you know, got to calm down. And that involves prioritizing one thing over whatever feeling your sense is.
And then how do we think about, like you're talking about the anxiety in the brain and then the feeling these senses, and how does that then play into health, like your physical health, mental health, all over? Because I'm sure if we're having these changes, like you had mentioned earlier, in the hippocampus, that has to somehow impact our overall health.
Absolutely.
And well-being, right?
And, you know, mental health is not usually an accident. It is continued by putting practices in place that further help your mental health. So, for example, right now, my son is going through college acceptances or, you know, rejections as the case may be. And it's a super stressful time for me because I hate seeing, you know, my kid rejected when, but he's such a good kid, right? It's terrible. So I am really careful right now to make sure I am exercising and being outside a lot. So, you know, putting habits and practices into your life that promote mental health is a great way to deal with chronic stress. I'm still stressed out about it, but I'm sure I'd be worse if I didn't have my gardening projects and my exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're on the East Coast. And so it's finally starting to break some spring weather. And so, yes, so we can get outside more. There's definitely something to be said about that.
I think being outside is the best anti-stress medicine that any doctor could prescribe. And just, we're not meant to be inside all the time. Teenagers, come out of your rooms. You know, they
get off the device. Come
just
out.
Get off be the human. Device and go outside, or go tell somebody else you're worried about stuff, not me, because we're meant to be outside. There's something about nature that is super relaxing for people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you kind of weave this into talking a little bit about your book, Mommy, My Head Hurts?
Well, I think I can. Mommy, My Head Hurts was my first book because, you know, I am a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist, so I deal with brain stuff. And I actually got into ADHD because a lot of times when kids' heads were hurting, it was because of stress in their lives from ADHD. So that's kind of how I got into the ADHD field in the first place. But headaches like ADHD, I think, are very complicated and involve not just sort of a biologic process, but also a lot of environmental and social types of influences as well. So, you know, I tried to give a guide that would help parents.
So what are some lesser known features that parents might not be aware of then, that I'm sure you've brought out in this book and in your work and the work that you do?
So, you know, I try to have a holistic approach, really. And, you know, there is biology, but I firmly believe that biology can be influenced by things in our lives as well. So, you know, in the headache field, paying attention to things like sleeping, eating, hydration, and stress influence the biology of headaches. Frequently and currently, for example, dealing with a patient who has vomiting and nausea a lot, they're trying to figure out why that is. And they are also having headaches that are out of control, and everyone's extremely worried that the kid has an unnamed, unfound disease. Kid's going through 25 tests and biopsies and this is and that's tubes every, you know, whatever. But the most common cause of that is stress, but it's hard to get people to recognize that. And we don't want to miss the, you know, an underlying biological process that's fixable. But when you check enough, it's foolish to overlook a common cause of those biologic problems. But it's unfortunately one that we have no test for, right? The stressometer is lacking.
But I think, I mean, if we could have one, whew, that would,
oh,
that would
my
be great.
Gosh, my job would be 20 times easier all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that you say that, because I think it's helpful even for educators in the classroom to have that knowledge in terms of stress and how that impacts, you know, attention, memory, processing, and how that impacts, you know, education and academics.
Absolutely. So, I mean, when you're taking a test or when you're coaching somebody how to take a test, you know, teaching them, okay, I know you have a limited amount of time on the test, but taking a few minutes at the beginning to calm down is a really good investment because then you have a better brain to take the test with.
Absolutely. So what are some other coaching strategies that you can help provide for parents and caregivers and teachers in terms of as it relates to academics or as it relates to just our typical day?
Well, what you're trying to do is build a kid who is able to problem solve. So instead of telling the kid all of, you know, do this, do that, say, kid, here's the problem. We need to leave in an hour and you're never ready. How are you going to solve that? You know, how are you going to do it? Kid who doesn't want to do their homework, it's like, I get it. You don't want to do it right after school. Here are your hours in your afternoon. Here's your, when your soccer practice is. When are you going to fit your homework in? You know, one of the nicest things that somebody ever said to me was, you know, you do what you say you'll do. Like, yes, I do. So part of it is me saying I'm going to do it. If somebody told me to do it, that kind of part of me that says no leaps to the forefront. So it becomes an instant burden. And then my focus for it goes down automatically. So having your child have a role in, not, you know, I'm not saying that your child is the boss of you. And I'm not saying that you don't have veto power, but, you know, why don't you try it their way once in a while? And if it doesn't go well, you know, like, kind of point that out. You didn't actually get ready in time. What do you think you can fix so that next time you can get ready? And, you know, again, the kid doesn't necessarily care that you have to be on work, you know, at a certain time. The kid's perspective is, if I'm late, that's less school that I have to do. So trying to see things from the kid's perspective and kind of coach your way from the where their brain is at the time would be really helpful.
I love the power of choice. I do it in my home and you know, in a classroom and with clients that I work with. I think it's empowering for the individual and just, you know, and we also kind of joke in terms of assuming the sale, right? So if you're going to do a power of choice, you're going to assume two positive things, like, are, you know, are we doing this in 5 minutes or 10 minutes?
Yeah.
So you kind of know it's going to be slanted in your way, but you are giving that power of choice because there is definitely more of that buy-in there. And it's also a life skill, right? Teaching a student, a child to problem solve is a life skill that you're going to need, you know, again, in that future education, employment, and independence, to be able to problem solve. How did that go for you? You know, I don't, you know, and not add our two cents as the adult, because sometimes it is really easy to want to add our two cents and say, well, this is how it went, but just, you know, having that child then be able to process that actively in the moment of how did that, what could we do different with that?
What could you do different? Because it's you.
I like that. That's right. That's right.
It's not me turning in our homework. It is you and your stuff. So ownership is extremely important.
Do you see kids when they are they able to recognize the signs when they're starting to lose focus, say in a classroom setting or in a situation where they would need to have that focus in the forefront?
Oh, you know, it kind of depends on the kid and the age and the, you know, really the individual person and where they are at the time. It depends on their level of caring. It depends on, you know, whether they're sad or happy or other things. So there's no blanket answer to that question. Again, you know, you could kind of really visualize it well. And by thinking of two different sports figures, you know, there's Steph Curry focused and there's Steph Curry less focused. I mean, even he has a harder chance of hitting the baskets when he's looking or thinking some about other things, right? So, you know, trying to coach that athletic model is something that kids can relate to, right? Who would you rather have on your team, you as a focused person or you as a less focused person?
Right. There you go. What are some lesser known features of ADHD that a parent may not be aware of? Like we just talked about headaches, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. You know, there are other things that are like, you know, sleep deprivation and more stress and nausea and all that, school avoidance. But on a more positive thing, I had a dad come in to see me with his kid. His kid was 6 or 7. And my attitude was, just a kid here, you know, got lots of time. We'll work on this, you know, we'll fix it. And the dad is kind of looking at me with this look. And what happened was that some preschool teacher told the dad that the kid was going to wind up in prison someday because the kid hit another kid. Like,
oh no,
dude, that is the wrong preschool to be in. You know, yeah. That's terrible. So for 2 years, he's been visualizing that his kid is going to wind up in jail and, you know, all these other things. Ugh. You know, it was a relief for him to hear that his 6 or 7 year old had time to get better and was going to be okay if the next 10 years went well, and how to do that. So I was really grateful that we were able to talk about that, because I didn't really know that attitude coming in. I mean, I never would have said anything like that. So
big jump from pre-K to
right. And this was some sort of teacher, but you know, you do tend to remember all the negative things people say about your kids more than the positives. That's the way our brains work. We have this negativity bias in our brains where we remember the bad things and not the good things as much. So, you know, what's important is not how well your kid does in school. What's important is the connection that you have. And also what's important is not to drive distracted. So, you know, that's where ADHD really gets dangerous, right? So your kid's going to be okay unless he's, you know, in a car juggling 18 things, which means that when you're driving him around, you got to put the distractions away too. So I know that was a big jump, but, you know, that's another important thing, you know, ADHD in a car. We don't talk about it very much, but if you have ADHD, and I'm sure if your listeners are parents of kids with ADHD, there's a good chance they themselves have a fair amount of ADHD rippling around, then, you know, it's in your, I think it's your duty to provide a less distracted environment for driving. So if you know you're going to be distracted easily, please put your distractions away. That's a public service announcement from the pediatric neurologist here.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask the question, because parents ask me a lot, and I always remind them that this is not my field. They ask about medication. Uh-huh. What are your thoughts? What are some strategies? You know, parents that may be hesitant, you know, how do you guide? I mean, medication is not always the answer. And so how do you navigate those questions for parents?
Yeah. So the first decision is whether to start a medication, and, you know, the benefits have to be worse than the potential side effects, right?
Right.
You and I both have glasses. We could squint all day, but the benefits of wearing glasses are, you know, a slam dunk.
Right.
More than the side effects of, you know, it costs a certain amount or whatever. So, you know, with medication, I think about it when people are not able to make behavioral changes for a variety of reasons. I think about it when people are in crisis time, when their academics are really getting impacted. That's where the benefits could be huge. And medications help people get from a cycle of failure to that cycle of success. So I prescribe medications for people because I really believe that they can help some people. I do not prescribe medicines for everybody. And I always view medications as a tool in the toolbox for how do you get from unfocused to focus, but it is not the only tool. And it should not be used without behavioral management. Otherwise, it's totally artificial.
I like that answer. I like that answer. Just a tool in the toolbox, but not the main box. Right. So we have options.
For some people whose focus is terrible, you know, it's almost cruel not to give medications because you're asking them to do things that it is not in their biology to do. But for milder versions of ADHD, which is the great majority of people getting diagnosed at this point, then medications can be more optional. In terms of reading, medications do not fix dyslexia. But if your attention is such that by the bottom of the page, you're not thinking about what you've been reading, it makes reading torturous. And sometimes attention is an important component of reading. And so by treating attention, even if you have dyslexia or reading processing disorders of whatever kind, your reading can improve. I've seen handwriting improve.
Yeah. Sometimes it just makes such a huge difference and, you know, and that support for the kiddo. So kind of as we wind down, what should I ask that I didn't know enough to ask?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, we started by saying that there's so much to talk about and we ended by saying, you know, what else should we talk about? Right. And, you know, the answer to that really is very individual. But the main thing that I would say that I want your listeners to take away is that there's reasons to remain positive and hopeful. You might have a kid that you feel like you don't know what else to do and you're giving up on. Everybody probably feels that way as a parent sometimes. And in some respect, I've had 4 kids and they've all made me crazy in certain ways. But, you know, as a parent, it's your job to be positive, be encouraging, be connected, and also demonstrate your ability to change and improve and deal with your issues. So, you know, your kids are smart. They're not going to do things when they see you doing things differently. You know, between what you say and what you do, you always believe what the person does, right? So you kind of have to wear what you're telling your kids.
Well, and what a gift to be that role model, right? Because I think is such a gift because then you're showing your kids that I'm an adult, but I can still change and grow and better myself and learn about myself. And, you know, we can continue to strive to be an amazing person and be good for the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, we both are creatures who can change and we're neither one of us a finished product, right?
That's right.
So, and teaching your kids to find ways to enjoy life and to make their own fun will help their focus too. So, you know, we all focus better if something's fun and interesting. Guess what? Sometimes you have to be the one to make it fun and interesting, right? That's the difference between entertainment and life. So, you know, if you want a fun and interesting life, you better think of ways to make your life fun and interesting, and that will improve your focus.
Well, and I think just saying that line is pretty spectacular, right? Oh. Because there's oftentimes kids will say, I'm bored, but
not in my house.
That's right. Well, not in mine either. We flipped that script, but to offer that as using that language really then opens up the door for growth and a lot more.
That's exactly right. Oh my gosh. I hate it when people tell me they're bored.
No, right. Absolutely not. So if you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
The one tip would be positive. Don't be, you can't be insincere, but you have to find ways to be positive for your kid. So your kid finds ways to be positive for themselves. It's a lot of words for one billboard,
but the positive is a good one.
The positive, you know, that's right. You know, you want your kids to remember that feeling when they're with you, and it's hard. You feel like you have to be the one to correct them. You know what? Not always. Let society step in and do some correcting sometimes.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing to say. This has been so incredible for you to come and share your time with us and your wisdom. I really appreciate all the information that you have provided, and I will put your information in the show notes so people know where to find you and how to find your books. And so I want to thank you for joining the Special Ed Strategist podcast. And this is the pod that offers all things special ed. Again, I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. And if you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. And if you're new to our podcast, give us a like and a follow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for joining us today for our Special Ed Strategist podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.